So today is Wednesday, it's July 11th, 2018. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History with Sam Wolfskill. And Sam spells his name SamUelWolfskill. And my name is Tom Martin, MARTIN. We are at Sam and Phyllis's house, his wife. And Sam, what year were you born?
I was born in 1935.
Where?
Reading, Pennsylvania.
What were your folks doing there?
My parents lived halfway between Reading and Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I wound up at the Reading Hospital to be born. But my dad was working as a salesman for an egg distributor.
Okay. Brothers and sisters?
I've got one brother. His name is David.
Older or younger?
He's younger.
Okay.
And he's passed away about a year ago.
Okay, I'm sorry. Now, Wolfskill is a very interesting name for American pioneering and exploring of the West. Are you related to William Wolfskill?
Indirectly, yes. He was a great-great uncle of some sort or other.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Any family stories about him?
No, didn't even know about him until I became, probably 35, 40 years old.
Okay. Did you grow up exploring in the Pennsylvania woods at all? What was your childhood like?
Oh, yes. I lost my father at an early age. I was about 14 years old. But Mom always raised us to be independent. And as a result, we were very active in Boy Scouts, my brother and I, and did a lot of camping and spent a lot of time in the woods and Boy Scout camps and hikes along the Appalachian Trail and that stuff.
Did you get into birding? Did you get into botany? Were you interested in the flora and the fauna?
At the time, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I was a young person, but when I got into college, I decided in either one of two majors. One of them would have been oceanography, the other one would have been forestry, and I picked forestry and went for that goal.
I'm sorry, tell me again the year you were born, 1930?
35.
Okay. Did you serve in World War II?
Nope, I was in between. The only thing, I served in the service, but it was during the Cuban crisis, and
okay. No
wars on either side until I got out. Then Vietnam took off after World War II.
Okay. Where did you end up going to college?
I went to Heidelberg College in Tiffin, Ohio, got an undergraduate degree there. And from there, I went on to Duke University and picked up a master's in forestry in 19... Good Lord, I can't remember, but it was 69, I think.
Did you know Charlie Newland?
No.
Okay. I'm just shooting another forester name out there. He came out and did his student rotations with the mill here in Flagstaff in the 50s. And in their forestry program, they wanted them to get out and actually work with the agency out in the field. And so they had him out here with the Coconino, or the Kaibab, I guess, and so he was out here then.
There were two people out here from Duke. One of them was the founder of the School of Forestry here at the Northern Arizona University, and he, Chuck Miner was his name, and he started the School of Forestry here at Northern Arizona University.
Is that M-I-N-E-R?
M-I-N-O-R, I think.
Okay.
But I'm not positive.
Okay.
And also there was another researcher out here for several years, but he's passed away since.
Nice. Started the NAU School of Forestry?
Yeah.
Okay. What year did you graduate with your master's, do you remember?
59.
Okay. So you're in Ohio.
Tiffin, and I did majored in biology,
okay.
Heavy biology, and then upon you complete 3 years, there was a program set up by Duke University where upon completing 3 years, they would accept you at Duke University for a summer and 2 full college years. And
so there you
got your master's in 5.5 years rather than stretching it out further. So it worked out real well that way.
And when you graduated from Duke then with your master's, then what?
Well, the summer before I graduated, I was looking for a job in the West, and I applied several places, got an offer from up in Montana, but that was not a very challenging job. It was just pulling ribes, which is a weed. And the other job was a timber inventory down on the Lincoln National Forest in southern Arizona or southern New Mexico by White Sands in that area. And I took that job for the summer.
Okay.
Went back to college. Finished, and then came, I liked it so darn much out here. The ranger helped sponsor me come back the next year for a special project, and I worked with that ranger on a special project during doing a recreation inventory throughout the entire national forest, locating potential camping areas and recreation areas for the future.
Who was that person, and tell me more about that program?
It was a program called National Forest Outdoor Recreation Review. And the person I worked with was the ranger I had the previous summer, and he was detailed on it and picked me as his assistant. And so I covered all the ranger districts along the Lincoln National Forest, inventorying potential areas for recreation.
How did that turn into a career?
Well, that was my step into the Forest Service, and from there on I went on to career conditional. While I was on career conditional, I was drafted, of course, spent 2 years in the Army, and had a pretty cushy job. I was working in Denver, Colorado in medical research.
What kind of research?
Well, we were trying to figure out if a person could synthesize its own vitamin C.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I spent 2 years working on that.
Oh, my gosh. That's a little far from forestry. Oh, you have a biology degree, but still.
Huh? That's right, yeah. Huh? It was a small lab. It maybe had about, 40 or less draftees in there, and, we all worked for high-powered PhDs in chemistry and biochemistry and physiology and veterinarians. They were doing all kinds of different studies there, different medical studies, one experimenting with animals, and one's different surgeries and that sort of stuff, as well as a lot of chemical and physiological stuff.
Okay.
It was an interesting 2 years.
Yeah. And then after your service in Denver Army...
I went back to New Mexico.
Okay.
And they took me in.
Back to Lincoln?
Back to the Lincoln, and they didn't really have a position there, but they were holding me till something came over, to speak. And that's when I went to the North Kaibab, about 6 months after that. So in about February of 1963, I wound up on the North Kaibab. Here in Arizona.
Where were you based out of? Were you based out of Fredonia then?
Yes.
Okay.
Fredonia, there were two ranger districts on the North Kaibab. There was the Big Springs district on the west side and the Jacob Lake district primarily on the east side. I worked on the west side most of the time in timber management, which was not much more than marking trees for logging, which was a big operation up there at the time, and then spent 2 weeks in the sawmill measuring logs as they went through to get paid, and then back to the woods for 2 weeks to mark, and that lasted for several years. Finally, I slipped over to the other district and went in as essentially the assistant ranger, where I did lots of different things, in recreation management, range management, timber management, and whatever the other people didn't want to do, I seemed to get.
Let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
What was Fredonia like in 1963?
Very small town. When I got there, I wasn't real happy being there. It was pretty isolated. By the time it was time to leave, it was the last thing from my mind to leave. I really liked it. And I spent a lot of time just enjoying the northern, southern Utah and northern Arizona. And went into the Grand Canyon, some areas off the forest, which are now the park, which weren't at that time were the National Forest, and into the park. It was just, that's where the Mount Trumbull stories come in, of course.
When was the first time you got out to Torreweep then? Out toward John Riffey, Ranger John Riffey's place?
Probably about 65, 66.
Okay.
That's when I went over to the Jacob Lake District from the Fredonia District. And that was an interesting story. The Kaibab National Forest had 17,000, roughly 17,000 acres out around Mount Trumbull. Or it was Mount Trumbull and Mount Logan. Nobody wanted to go there. It was a long drive out. It took maybe 3 or 4 hours to get out there on rough roads. So I was one the designated keeper of the 17,000 acres. And I didn't go out much in the winter, which was necessary. The kind of activities we had out there were very limited. There wasn't much recreation, of course, and what few people ever did come, they went to Torreweep, they never came over to Mount Trumbull. So we did have some grazing permittees that I'd meet with. One book that's mentioned in the book is a Smoots, and that's the only one I can remember. But we had about three of them.
Tell me about the Smootses.
I didn't know them very well. I just ran across him every once in a while. During the summer when he was out there looking after his livestock.
S-M-U-T-Z?
I think that's it. It's in the book.
Yeah. And they had been out there a long time. Mm-hmm. They had developed some springs out there, and it was tough.
Yeah, that was a rough area. There was no water out there to speak of, which just a tough area. Actually, it was one of the few places right next to, the monument was there and the forest was there. And from what I understand, the rest of it was homesteading. It goes way back. And this is where a lot of people tried to make a living, and most of them failed. I think Al Craig was the only one that lasted out of all of them.
And well, let's talk about Al. When was the first time you met him?
It was one of my first trips out there. I was told that there are several people you should contact out there, Al Craig being one and John Riffey being the other. And I went out to see them. Al was only maybe 10, 15 minute drive from Nixon Springs where we had the camp. And John was a little bit further over to Torreweep. But those are the two people I got to know most out there.
And that would have been, so you were in Fredonia in 63. When was the first time you started exploring? I mean, so you were marking timber up on the high country and then down at the mill, which was there in Fredonia.
In Fredonia, yes.
Yeah, so back and forth. But during the weekends and whatnot, would you keep exploring sort of south and west and up points east? And
didn't go to the strip too much. I was going up north to Zion, Bryce, and all the parks.
Okay. Okay.
And of course, I didn't really get out till around 60, mid-60s out to the, except one trip out there to look over the edge.
Okay.
I never got out to Torreweep except once until the mid-60s.
Until you got assigned to Jacob Lake.
Well, assigned to Jacob Lake and inherited that 17,000 acres.
Can you help me? Because I'm trying to figure this out. You said there were two districts. There's the Big Springs and the Jacob Lake districts.
Right. Mm-hmm.
No, when I think about this geographically, Jacob Lake is up on the high country, and Big Springs is kind of down low and a little further west. And yet it sounds like when you were managing Jacob Lake, you spent time way west,
yeah,
out on the strip.
Right.
How did that work management zone-wise?
Big Springs was the big district.
Okay.
It was the one where all the timber people were, you know, and all the big sales, even if they infringed on Jacob Lake, they were managed by Big Springs.
And they had buildings down there, didn't they? They're still there today, a headquarters kind of area there?
Where
Big Springs?
Oh, yes, yes. And we'd be out there, stay out there and camp all week.
Okay.
And mark timber and then come back into town and work at the mill for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And that's how we worked back and forth on that.
Where were the Jacob Lake offices at the time?
At Jacob Lake.
Okay.
Well, the office, the main office was in Fredonia. They shared the building. The field camp was at Jacob Lake.
Okay.
And just like Big Springs was a field camp for...
So then when you ended up spending time out at Mount Trumbull, out at Nixon Spring out there, then you would be based out of Fredonia. Is that right?
Right.
Or would you have to go up to Jacob Lake, up to that area, and then go... I mean, how did that work logistically?
Well, you just left Fredonia. For some reason or other, they just assigned... Even though it was further west, they assigned Jacob Lake the isolated island.
Okay.
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 And that's the reason. And you just leave from Fredonia to go out. There's the normal road everybody uses to go out to Torweeb.
What was that road like back in this would have been 66 or 7?
Yeah, 60 in the late
65.
Mid 60s on to the later 60s, yeah.
What was that road like?
It was rough. They have Mojave County. Of course, that's all part of Mojave County. And very few people live in Mojave County north of the canyon. I think there's Bundyville. And, of course, there's Colorado City. Hilldale's in Utah. So that and a few other isolated ranches, and that was about the extent of it until you got down to that little town right on the corner. Some greenfield or something, right on the way to Vegas on highway from St. George to Vegas.
Uh-huh.
There's a little community, can't remember the name of the town now.
I keep thinking of Mount Trumbull, but that's not
what you're thinking.
This is
on the highway. This is a main freeway
that
goes between Vegas and St. George. Littlefield, I think it was called. It's just a really tiny little spot, and it's just a little piece of Arizona that's surrounded by Utah and Nevada.
Okay.
It's just that little corner you cut through. And that was about the extent of the people in Mojave County, Northside. They did have a county road maintainer up there, and a fellow by the name of Finnegan, and I can't spell it.
You think it was?
It's Irish to Finnegan.
Okay.
Finnegan, and I think one of them was just killed a few years ago, and had an incident up in Oregon. They were closely associated with the Bundys.
Oh, okay.
And I think one of them was killed up there, probably the one. But the father-son did all the road maintenance out there, and it was just a tough thing to keep up with.
Right,
and
right.
The roads were always
bad. It's hundreds of miles of dirt roads.
Oh yes, all over.
And it rains and it snows and there's nobody out there.
Not very many.
No. So how long would it take you to drive from Fredonia out to John's place, to John Riffey's place?
Three and a half hours, something like that.
No.
It's almost a half a day.
Okay.
It depended on the weather too, because a lot of times you were going out in muddy conditions. I never did get stuck, but came close.
So the Grand Canyon National Monument was a wedge of land surrounded by Forest Service land to the north and the homesteading land.
Right.
And Grand Canyon National Park was actually further east. This was before the 75 enlargement.
It was up the North Rim.
Right.
It was up there.
Right, and the North Rim and South Rim. But
right, but the monument was
up
still...
Up to Nankoui.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The monument was still just a separate item out there. And John was not a typical forest ranger. He was one of those fellows that was a land manager. rather than a people manager.
How long did it take you to figure that out?
Well, based on his personality, a long time, you know, but he was really out there not to entertain the public, but to manage the land, because there was grazing going on that land.
That's right.
And all those homesteaders and had permits to graze on the park as well as the forest. And the BLM land also adjacent to that.
Right, right. So it would have been 65 the first time you met Riffy? And that's
65, 66, yeah.
Okay. What do you remember about that first encounter?
Not a whole lot. It's when I got to know him a little better, I got to meet him. But I just don't remember a whole lot, except I really liked the person, and mm-hmm. that's about the extent of it. And then once I'd gone out there several times, ran across him, I got to know him a little bit better. And he was one of the, well, the book describes it all. He's just a very helpful person. One time, I was out there, and John Riffy had an airplane he called Pogo, and he would fly air patrol for the park and that end as well, or the monument as well as the forest for us. There was an agreement. And he called me one day while I was out there on the radio and told me there was a fire. And I said, okay. He says, well, I'll land this plane and then I'll meet you up there. And so I went around. I had to go all the way around the mountain. It was on Mount Trumbull, the backside of Mount Trumbull. And so I went around the mountain and walked up to the fire. And there was John. He already had the fire just about out.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's when I had one of my real long chats with him, you know, and visited with him.
And what did you learn?
Oh, the best thing I learned is his personality was just, it's a pleasure to be around. No matter what, I don't think he ever met a stranger. He was just one of those people that was a delight to be around. And actually, as far as work goes, he was a hard worker, I know that, and he knew that country very well. But so I relied on him a lot later after that, you know, for certain things. And one summer I had the good fortune of having enough money to hire two summer students to work out there in the summer as fire prevention people and fire control people. And John did most of the training for those kids. There were two students, college students.
Do you remember their names?
No, I don't.
Okay.
It's been a long time.
Uh-huh.
And that's the only year I had money
to hire hands.
Yeah, other than that, it was me.
Okay. Huh. So John worked for and was the only employee of the Park Service at the Grand Canyon National Monument.
Right.
So he was the superintendent, he was the assistant superintendent, he was the chief of law enforcement, he was the maintenance guy, he was the janitor, he was a secretary and everything.
He was.
What kind of dress did he wear? When you first met him, what was he wearing?
No uniform. He's always in Levi's and a shirt. Just a plain old dress shirt, usually.
And cowboy boots? Cowboy hat?
Yeah. I don't remember the hat so much, but yeah.
Okay.
He was just down there, just like a regular rancher around
uh-huh.
there. That's put it out. And I never did see him until this photograph, and he's still not in uniform, if I remember right. Nope. He's still...
And the photograph you're looking at, Sam, is John Riffy receiving his 40-year ruby pin from Superintendent Merle Stitt.
Right.
And here's Superintendent Stitt all dressed to the 9 Class A uniform, not a speck of dust on it. And there is John Riffy in his floppy hat and his plaid shirt and his puffy jacket.
Yep. That's him. Fun guy.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like John.
Yeah. So you guys were connected by radio.
Yes. Not not all the time. I mean, it was one of those things.
How did that work?
When John went in the air, he went on 10-8 to fly.
Okay.
That's about the only time.
So the Forest Service would have had its own radios to connect its people together.
He had one of our radios.
Okay.
And he had a handheld set, and of course we had them in the trucks as well as handheld. So that's how we communicated, but there was never a whole lot of communication. It was always just, if you want to see John, go see John. You can't get him on the radio unless he's in the air.
Did the plane make sense to you guys? I mean, I'm just thinking, why didn't the Forest Service have a plane? Because you've got 17,000 acres. That's a chunk of change. And that's just the west side, not the east side.
Yeah, there was a special agreement with John somehow or other, because we did fly air patrol on the regular Kaibab Plateau, but
okay.
That was out of Kanab.
Oh.
You know, and
okay.
A contractor out of Kanab flew patrol there. And I guess rather than send that plane all the way out there, John was willing to do it.
Okay.
And they paid him to do it.
Oh, great. All right. I appreciate that. It would make sense. But keeping the gasoline and maintenance
yeah.
of the plane, and wonderful.
Yeah, somehow or other. The gasoline was probably part, you know, all that was through the Park Service. It wasn't John
mm-hmm.
personally.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Which was great because it was a super idea. It's so remote there.
Yeah. And he's going up anyhow, so why not fly an extra, 17,000 acres you can fly over in 5 minutes, you know.
Yeah. Did he ever take you flying?
No, I never went up with him.
Okay, okay. So John had a way of, as the book talks about, naming things in a creative
yeah.
kind of way. Did you catch on to that pretty quickly?
Not too much, no. I didn't catch on to it until I read the book.
Okay.
Yeah, it always, he probably used those words, but they just kind of came natural. I mean, I understood what he was saying when he said them.
Okay. So it took 3 hours or so to get from Fredonia out to his ranger station, and that wasn't at the rim.
No.
Getting to the rim was even a further drive.
Right.
Yet. How many vehicles did you go through?
None really. They just, government replaced them before they were totally out. It wasn't that, if you took your time, it wasn't that hard on a vehicle.
Okay.
That's why it took so long. You could probably go out there a lot faster and be hard on a vehicle.
Got it. But you'd lose your muffler and...
Yeah, or a lot of things.
Tires.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, no, we didn't go through any vehicles. I know I always had an older vehicle, but it was reliable.
Okay. Nice. And the maintenance, was that done in Fredonia then, or was maintenance out of Kanab? How did that work?
Really, what happened was the Forest Service every month had a preventive maintenance check. That's where you yourself went through your vehicle and checked the list of a whole bunch of things off. If anything was wrong mechanically, it usually went to a service station locally.
Huh. Okay. That makes sense.
But they did take pride in their vehicles and people taking care of their vehicles. I mean, you had to because you were doing it every month.
And you really needed that vehicle. I mean, you wouldn't want it to break down out there because it would be a long, long walk.
Yeah. Not too much to hitchhike with either.
So was John's wife living with him at the time, 65, do you remember? Did you meet? He had two wives.
Yeah. Yeah, and I met the second one.
Okay.
I never met the first one.
Okay.
And she was a birder. She liked to... She was an ornithologist, really. And as a result, she had study plots all over. And she talked to me one day and says, "Hey, look, I'm putting up the, nothing, you know, just designating an area for a plot.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing physical going on to it." And she said, "Do you need a permit?" And I said, "Nah." I didn't see any purpose in it, you know. And she went back and visited those plots for years, but there was nothing there except an inventory of birds.
Right. And she knew the area and would walk in that area, and that was that.
That was it.
Wonderful.
I'm sure she needed a permit, but I wasn't about to hassle on that.
Yeah, yeah. So there were other people out there besides John Riffey. There were a few other families trying to survive out there on the strip. Did you ever meet Chet Bundy, Chester?
No, I think I had one run-in with the Bundys and all my trips out there. And that was, I guess I got to go back and get the story squared away a little bit. Mount Trumbull was 17,000 acres. Back during the Kennedy administration, Congress allocated a large sum of money, and I don't know how much, to be spent by the U.S. Forest Service in Mojave County. And the only piece of land in Mojave County that was national forest was Mount Trumbull, Mount Logan. As a result, they got this chunk of money. I think it was to help. I think this all happened a little bit before I got there, but the money was probably to help the Native Americans. They hired the Native Americans to do pre-commercial thinning on that area. They put a brand new fence all the way around the monument, or the park, or forest, and that's 17,000 acres. And then they also built at Dixon Springs, they built a duplex and a garage and put in a generator and a gigantic butane tank, and there were two rooms to live in out there at Dixon Springs. And that's where I would stay when I go out, and it was only maybe a 15-minute drive to Al Craig's place, but quite a ways over to John. As a result of that, I lost track of where I'm going.
We were talking about Chet or Chester
Chet, yeah,
Bundy.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's right.
And then there was Orville and Atwood Bundy. There were a lot of Bundys out there.
There was a whole village of Bundys. It was called Bundyville. And it was further down the road, quite a bit of ways.
A little further to the west, out the other side of the Hurricane Cliffs there.
Mm-hmm.
And then down toward Whitmore Wash, that area down that side.
That's right.
Okay.
Anyhow, I think one night that I had a friend of mine, or one of the guys I worked with out there, we were spending the night and heard some shots over around the pond at, I think, at Dixon Springs. There was a pond full of, it's water. It was one of the few springs around, and it was continually running water. And so we got out of bed and walked over there, and I think they were Bundys, but I think they were poaching. We didn't push it too far because they had the guns.
And that was your only run-in with them?
And that's, I think if that was Bundy's, that's the only run-in I ever had with them. Otherwise, I never did.
Okay. And they were, I'm thinking about this, it's like, of course, the Forest Service land was further east of that western strip land.
Yeah.
Where
it's quite a ways.
Yeah, yeah. Because Chet was down there in the 50s and 60s.
Yep.
Lots of family there. And I guess the Bundys just had a large reunion out there last year or the year before, which I did not get a chance to get to. But
I really never met any that I know of.
Okay.
You know.
So then, without connecting to the people to the west, again, that was the homesteaded land, more Bureau of Land Management land out there. Actually, near Dixon Springs would have been Al Craig. Was Jim White still alive then, or he had already been shot? Okay.
I think he was, oh yeah.
Right.
The only one I remember, the only places I remember were Al Craig's and also the Smoot's place, and they were only there part of the year, you know.
Okay.
And they weren't living there. They just came down for a weekend or something, look after their cattle, and then went back up north into Utah. Where they lived, I have no idea.
Okay. So not a lot of people out there.
Nope.
And What do you remember the first time you met Al Craig? His wife Mary?
Yeah, I can't remember specifically the first time. Somehow or other, it was one of those. I think what it is they told me if I needed gas, go over to Al Craig's. And I think that's how I met him.
Okay.
Al, whenever he come to Fredonia, he'd bring in at least a 55-gallon drum, maybe two, on his truck, and fill them up with gas. And Al had one of these old-fashioned gas pumps that you crank and the water, then gravity flows into the, and that's where we get gas.
So you would pull this thing back and forth, and it would pump gas into a clear glass chamber?
Yeah, up about 6 foot high up above.
And then there was a hose off of that.
And gravity fed into the
truck. And you watched
that
go back down into the truck.
Yeah.
And he had one of those set up in his place.
Yeah, and that's how I think I got to Al, meet Al, was through getting gas so I could get home.
And would you pay for that? Was there money? How did that work out?
That was fun. Government had credit cards at that time.
They didn't. There were credit card swipers out there. Did that work?
For a while, he didn't. Everything was filled out by hand.
Okay.
And then later on, he got a swiper.
But, he actually did.
But there was still a lot of hand filling, too.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that was it. And
okay.
It was interesting because it was an event to get gas.
Mm.
And then we got to know Al and Mary, because they loved to visit too, and you get to hanging out with them a lot. And they were one of these places. I stayed out there with them one time. Instead of staying at Nixon Springs, I went over there and they invited me to stay, and they had a dugout next to their house. And I stayed in the dugout, and what a delightful place that was.
Nice.
It was cool in there when it was hot outside. That was quite a deal, because we didn't have air conditioning, and then, you know, it wasn't that bad to sleep over there in Mount Trumbull because it was still pretty high. But that was even cooler. It's just a nice, pleasant temperature all night long. But it was just one of those things. You just go over, and every time you went, you might as well kill an hour or two, because they don't ever get much company, and as a result, it was just what you did.
And would you talk about the news, talk about the range, talk about...
Oh, just about anything. I just can't remember specifically anything that really dug in deep, you know, like politics or anything like that. Never talked about that, you know.
Okay. Okay.
But it was interesting.
Hmm. And Al was a very good mechanic.
Yeah.
Did he do any mechanic work with you out there on anything?
Not on our equipment, no.
Okay.
Not that I know of. I don't think we ever had the problem, you know, but he did. He was a good mechanic, and he could make things work with his junk pile, really.
With very little.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, there's a great story of him picking up the 150-mile rights to use that area, proved by... I'm not sure whether he got that from Riffy or from the fellow who was there one summer when Riffy wasn't there. But he ended up going out looking over the edge and saw that. And I know he went out there with Riffy helping to get his cattle down there. And there was water down there. And it was the precious, most precious thing, because there was no water like that anywhere around. And it just saved his
livestock. This is when he got his permit to go down.
Yeah.
Into the canyon. Yeah.
Yeah.
I read about that. I knew nothing about it at the time.
Okay.
But I did read about that.
When you met him out there in 60, so I'm assuming this is 66 or so.
67, yeah.
67. Was he still running cattle? Or had he stopped
there? There were no.
Okay.
No cattle. The only thing I can remember is he was a stickler for closing his gates. And one day I drove out Nixon Springs, decided I'd go see John, or Hal. So I headed over there, and the gate was shut. So I got out of the truck, opened up the gate, drove through, closed the gate, and right next to you on the left-hand side there was this shallow grave. And I looked at it, and there was a headstone on it, and it says, "Here lies the last SOB that didn't close the gate."
That's nice.
Yeah, that was one I'll remember forever.
Nice. Very nice. And did Al set that up?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, he made that himself.
Great. As a way to help people who didn't know, if the gate's open, leave it open. If the gate's closed, leave it closed. I mean, just it's how you deal with gates. But, oh my gosh.
That was cute.
That's great. That's
kind of cool. Got my eye real big.
What other neat things did you see like that?
The other thing that's so neat is the hospitality. That's the thing that really got me with both those individuals. Is just they just never met strangers. They were always welcoming and always glad to have you there, whether they were busy or not. They'd take time out. And you did a lot of visiting when you're out there. When you're out there for, you know, 3 or 4 days, you know, in the evenings things get pretty dull when you're by yourself. So you go visit.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Would you guys play any musical instruments at all?
No.
Or just visit?
Just visit.
Uh-huh. Okay. Would you bring any food over there? Would you try to bake a pie or something?
No, I wasn't much of a cook at that time.
Okay.
I was more or less eating out of a can.
Okay.
When I go out there, it's just about what you had, you know, because you had a refrigerator, but it was gas operated, and you had to turn it on when you got there, and you had to keep things cold before you got out there. So it didn't bother with anything but what you could eat out of a can, basically.
Hmm. Do you know the history of Nixon Springs, how the Forest Service ended up getting that land and that location there?
I have no idea why they have the 17,000 acres out there.
Okay.
It was really isolated and just, it belongs to the BLM and that's who has it now, and that's great, far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've been out there, but they built a real big lodge out there.
They did, yeah.
And I'd surprised the heck out of me when NAU was doing a lot of studies out there back in what, 90s?
Okay.
I don't know, but Wally Covington over at the university had a whole lot of different studies going on in there. And the BLM, I guess, built that sort of lodge. That's where the old ministry site was, too.
Okay.
And I went out once with a couple of the fellows that worked at NAU and spent the night there. And went around and see what they were doing, and that's the last time I've been to Mount Trumbull.
So when you were there in the 60s, you said there was a maintenance garage there, there was a couple buildings, you had water, you had propane. Did you entertain the Craigs? Did they come over to your place sometimes?
No, I always went over there.
Okay.
Because they never knew when I was coming.
I see.
I wasn't out there that frequently, you know, maybe. I'd say 7-8 times a year is all I'd be out there, and then only for several days.
Okay.
We had the Colorado City people logging on the forest there, and I'd go out and check on the loggers and also check on the ranchers. So most of that time was usually in the summer months.
Mm-hmm.
And the fall and the spring.
And then besides your occasional trips out to that area, what were you doing over on the Jacob Lake side, up on the high country there?
Oh, a little bit of everything. I was working on range management. I was doing all the studies on the grazing areas. We had the Buffalo Ranch down below in House Rock Valley, and that was part of the forest, too. We also had great ranchers on the top of the mountain grazing. This was the days when there weren't that many buffalo on the north side.
Okay.
They were all down on the ranch instead of all over the park in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
They were in their designated area in the forest.
Mm.
And occasionally we'd have a road buffalo or two. I think they'd run out into the forest and nobody would bother with them because they were just they were run off buffalo is what they were. They were, nobody wanted them anymore, and they just went out there and went to die, I guess.
Mm.
But,
or find some greener pasture from House Rock Valley.
Yeah, but
which
it was
is
always singles. It was
really
never, yeah, it was always a rogue by himself out there on the other side of the fence.
I managed to get across the fence.
Oh,
do you remember who were the caretakers out there?
Oh golly, I wish I could remember his name right now. He was good. I mean, he knew where those animals were. I don't think it's like the people that are out there today. And I can't remember his name, but he was outstanding as far as knowing where they were and keeping them where they should be. And then I don't know what happened after I left there, why, what, now they're everywhere but where they should be, I guess. But I wish I could remember his name, and it might come to me later, but I can't now. But it was just a plain old cowboy.
So how did that work? Because there's the Forest Service and the BLM. Of course, the Park Service was way further south where their land was.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I'm kind of leading into 1975 with the enlargement, Grand Canyon enlargement Act, that then all brought that up together. So before the Enlargement Act, the northeastern boundary of the Park Service was at Nankoweap. And upstream there was Marble Canyon National Monument, if I get that right. And BLM land went to the rim top.
Yeah.
And then BLM land, as it started going up the hillside, then braided into Forest Service land.
Yes.
Up to the top of the plateau there.
Yeah, basically the foot of the mountain, so to speak. Except I think some places it went to the rim, you know, over on the, what I'd say, the far west end.
Okay.
I think it went to the rim, but I'm not sure. I can't remember specifically the boundary.
So there was the Buffalo Ranch on the east side, the heavy timbered land up on top.
Right, all the way up the side of the mountain and down the other side.
Gaylord Stavely ran a hotel down near the park border. Did you meet him there?
No, he wasn't the owner at that time.
Okay.
It was a fella, family out of the valley somewhere, Tucson or Phoenix.
Okay.
And I, here again, I'm missing a name, but I know it very well.
No worries, no worries.
But they had it for years, and they also had the store across the street, from the Kaibab Lodge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
And somebody bought, I think one of the McCormick kids, Fredonia, bought the store.
Okay.
Eventually, I don't know if they still have it or not.
Hmm. Okay.
And I'm talking about kids. They were kids when, you know, this was much later. I think Gaylord bought the lodge eventually.
Okay. And then who was operating the Jacob Lake Lodge?
Oh, John? It's the same family. It's been there forever.
The Wright family?
No. This one I should remember. Rich, R-I-C-H.
Rich, thank you, the Riches.
And our field camp was right next to the lodge.
Okay.
Almost within a couple hundred yards.
That must have been good pies. Good eating up there.
Yeah. And of course they shut down during that time during the winter, so. You know, there's only one person. You usually had somebody up there during the winter to.
Would you keep somebody up there all winter?
It wasn't that bad. The road was maintained all the time.
Okay.
Over the mountain. The highway camp was right up there anyhow.
Oh, that's true. They got the yard up there with the snow plows and whatnot.
Yeah, they kept the road open. So they always had one person there kind of to. It's sort of like they do at the North Rim. They keep a couple. I think the concessionaire keeps a person there, and so does the Park Service during the winter.
Just as a maintenance.
Maintenance and
shovel snow if it gets too heavy on the roofs. And
fix the pipes if they bust. Sort of stuff.
So today, that 89A, going from the cut there on 89, going to Page, it goes on up over Jacob Lake and then back down to Fredonia, has a lot of semi-truck traffic on it. Did it have that much traffic? Big trucks on it back then?
Very often.
Okay.
At that time, and it's, I don't think the interstate was done between Vegas and St. George at that time, was it? And if it wasn't, that's, this was a shortcut for people coming out of Phoenix to go up and over the mountain. And at that time, about the only trucks I can remember are state highway trucks or cattle trucks.
Right.
And
right.
a few, maybe occasional
logging commercial trucks.
You know, people making deliveries to Fredonia or something.
But sure.
There was not much traffic in the winter over that road.
Okay. Okay.
And the best route would have been to go through Page anyhow. You know, rather than all the way over that mountain.
Yeah, once they.
Time-wise, I did it both ways, coming to Flagstaff, for instance, and it was about the same because you could go faster on 89 than you could 89A.
Right.
So by the time you went to Page and came back to Kanab, well, it was just about as fast as going over the mountain.
Okay, going out that way. Forest fires on Jacob Lake side would have been, I would assume, much more intense than forest fires on the out by Nixon Springs side, just because the range was so different.
The biggest fire they had that I can remember was right down near the park on the east side.
Okay.
It was called the Saddle Mountain Fire, but that was already happened before I got there.
Oh, okay.
And all those, for some reason or other, all those other fires that have been happening after I left, I have no reason, rationale why they should happen, you know, that much.
Yeah.
Except the number of people going over that mountain increased, you know, and carelessness, but it just, most of the fires, except for Saddle Mountain, weren't all that big when I was there.
Hmm. Okay.
We had one right on top, just to the west of Saddle Mountain. That was a blowdown. That's right. That was a blowdown that we salvaged. And then we had another one back towards Saddle Mountain. That was another blowdown. But those were winds and not fires.
Okay.
And as a result, I can remember. Well, that was one of the logging jobs that I worked on. Was that one blowdown that's towards Saddle Mountain? It was. It was Hosey Irby. He was a Jippo logger, just a little guy. He got run a couple, hired a couple people, and Hosey bought that blowdown. It was in the mixed conifer up there, just east of Kaibab Lodge. There was a blowdown years ago. And that's
okay.
What I'm talking about.
Okay.
And Hosey got the job. Hosey was one of the neatest guys I ever met, too. He was a black man from somewhere back in the southeast, you know. And just as a side point, that Caterpillar tractor you see down at the historic Pioneer Historic Museum,
yeah.
That was Hosey's.
Really?
Yeah. And then all his equipment looked like that.
J-O-S-I-E, do you think?
H-O-S-I-E, I think, Hosey.
And what was his last name?
I think it's Irvy, I-R-V-Y or I-R-V-N, one or the other.
Okay, or I-R-V-E-Y?
Could be.
Okay.
People, they know about him at the Historic Museum.
Okay.
That's for sure, because that's his, they told me that's his cat, and it always took him probably 40 minutes to get that thing fired up. It was just fun going over there, you know. And he always only have a couple swampers working with him and fellers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a delight, but he was quite a guy. He lived here in town.
He did, in Flag.
He raised Tennessee Walkers.
Really?
High-powered horses.
Yes.
And
okay, so now... Now I'm connecting up. I did an interview with a Grand Canyon National Park law enforcement ranger at Phantom Ranch in the mid-1960s, mid to late 1960s, named Ken Hulick. Ken ended up then being transferred to North Rim Lodge, and he was up there for a while. But he had a Tennessee Walker that he would take down to Phantom Ranch from the South Rim.
Yeah.
He loved that horse.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, where did he get that? But maybe he got it from Josie.
No, I don't think Josie got rid of his horses. He just loved to ride them.
Oh, he wouldn't sell them.
No, he just had one or two. He didn't raise them.
Okay.
He just had them.
Huh.
He was quite a guy. But then the Park Service also, while I was at the Grand Canyon, and those riot horses. They had a couple pair on.
Okay.
And I don't know how long they had them, but...
They still have a couple horses today.
The riot horses?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for special events and tour on the rim ride.
Yeah, when I was ranger at Tucson, the fellow that was in charge, I can't remember his name, who's responsible for those two horses. He was responsible for Park Service horses, I think.
Okay.
But whenever he went on vacation, he'd bring the horses to us because we'd look after them for him.
Hmm.
He didn't trust anybody else.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, at 2CM we had a stable and everything.
Uh-huh.
And we kept them there with our horses.
Nice. Nice. So there was a slow but steady push to enlarge Grand Canyon National Park in the early 70s.
Right.
Because the Grand Canyon goes from Lee's Ferry in the east to the Grand Wash Cliffs in the west, that's about 280 miles, and yet the park only went from Nankoweap to Deer Creek, which was a distance from roughly mile 55, roughly, to mile 100 and, I don't know, maybe 60 miles or so, 60 or 70 miles. So we're missing out quite a chunk of change.
Yeah.
What was your role with that, with the Forest Service? The
Enlargement Act?
Mm-hmm.
I got there just as after it happened.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that was 1975.
Yeah.
So were you stationed then up over there? In that, so you didn't get a chance to work with that?
No, I moved in after the Enlargement Act went.
Okay.
And that's when the Havasu got that old grazing allotment that they had on National Forest.
Yes.
They picked that up.
Right. And traditional use land into the park. They got some parkland access.
Yeah.
And before
they actually took it over, I think the only thing that happened was I was lucky enough to get a helicopter ride into the canyon to do an archaeological survey for about a week.
Okay.
That was forest that we were turning over to the Havasupai.
Okay. This would have been 1974-ish?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
Do you remember who the helicopter pilot was?
No. It was
contractor?
Well, it was one of the locals. It was
Halverson?
Grand Canyon. Halverson's helicopter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And we just chartered it, and then we stayed down there several days and had to make a beer run after 2 days and bring some. Then we came out 2 days after that.
Okay.
So
okay.
It was kind of a fun deal. It was just sort of more of a junket than anything, but we walked the canyon and found a lot of ruins that were on the National Forest that were about to go back to the Havasupai.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which were probably theirs anyway. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
Their land. So.
Some of them were rather modern, you know. One of them was a train, you know,
okay.
Somebody etched picked into the rocks.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It was rather interesting.
Huh.
But it was a fun trip. And that was right after I got there, so that was
so when did you make the move then from Fredonia to the south side?
Well, I didn't go right to the south side. I spent 6 years in Springerville.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I left Fredonia, went from assistant ranger there to timber staff over in Springerville.
What year did you leave Fredonia?
Oh, Lord, I don't have. It was probably the late 60s, early 70s. I can't remember specifically.
Okay.
And then I spent 6 years in Springerville and then went to south rim of the canyon.
And that would have made sense why you weren't conversant with all of the north side Forest Service, Park Service, were going to coalesce all this stuff.
No, it was all happening while I was in Sperryville.
Got it.
And I just got there on the tail end when we lost everything.
Yeah.
Which was no big deal.
What was the thinking at the time? Because it was funny that the Forest Service, was it the Forest Service that actually had the Esplanade above Deer Creek and to Pete's Creek?
They had
the Thunder River Trail there.
Yeah, that was all.
Yeah.
And I can remember going down Thunder River in the winter, and our crew was down there working on the trail.
Okay.
You know, in the winter months. But I don't think there was a whole lot of objection to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, and on my part, I thought, well, it more belongs to the park than it does the forest. Anyhow, because it's just nothing but sandstone down there.
It looks like the canyon anyway.
it was really a nice spot, but we had Thunder River at the time, and then that went, I don't know where Thunder River goes when it comes out of the side, whether it was, when it came out of the mountain, I guess it became, went on to the park after that, because that was the sand rocks.
Yeah, so I guess the boundary came to
the rim,
to Pete's Creek, and then jumped across the river. I don't know, I get confused there, because you have to look at the maps. But yeah, and there was a campground down there at where Thunder River met to Pete's Creek. There was a campground there, and I think that was Forest Service.
That campground wasn't there when I was there.
Really?
Yeah, okay. It was just, it's where we camped.
Okay. Okay.
But there was no campground. There wasn't anything there.
Oh, all right.
It was just a nice beach.
Were there any people coming out with stock to ride that trail, or were there backpackers out there hiking that?
Very few people knew about it.
Okay.
I think there were some avid canyon hikers that knew about it, but when we were down there, you know, we were down for 4 or 5 days just camping, and it rained the whole time. You know, so we were spending most of our time under a tarp.
Mm.
And then when we came back out, we got all the way to the top, and brand new fresh snow.
Yes.
So the trail crew says, well, come on down, we're coming out tomorrow.
Huh?
So we went back down, camped with them that night in the sand rocks, came back out again the next day, and the trail crew had a grader, you
okay.
know, because they knew where they, you know, it was nice weather down under, but it wasn't up on top.
That's right.
And they had a grader, so they just plowed their way out, and because the snow was too deep, we couldn't go through it in a pickup.
And you just followed them out?
Just had a two-wheel drive pickup, yeah.
Yeah.
Just put chains on and followed them out.
Uh-huh. Excellent.
Yeah.
Oh, very fun.
And we got lucky.
Did you meet Harvey Butcher at all?
Never.
Okay.
Nope. Never met him.
All right.
But I knew a lot about him, or a fair amount about him. Yeah, I heard of it.
And Springerville now, there's forest over there. Were you part of the logging operations going on over there?
Yes.
What were you doing?
I was timber staff over there.
Okay.
I'm one of the districts, one of the Springerville district.
Okay.
And at that time there was in the 70s, there was a lot of logging going on in the late 60s. And also the pulpwood at Snowflake was open, and we were cutting pulpwood to feed that mill too.
Okay.
There was a sawmill, big sawmill in McNary. There was a sawmill in Eager.
Hmm.
And that's where most of the timber went for those two areas.
Okay.
Right. That was an interesting time.
How so?
It was a total timber job, full time. I mean, it took all your time to manage. Well, we had a lot of loggers running around in every different direction.
Okay.
And I had one sales administrator, plus I'd do a lot of the administering myself because it's just too much for one guy.
And you'd have to make sure that they were cutting where they were supposed to cut and what they were supposed to cut?
Designating the trees to be cut.
Okay.
Measuring the stuff at the sawmill. I had a scaling crew that was at the sawmill all the time. They ran two shifts, usually.
Okay.
So it was a busy time.
Yeah.
That was the one in Eager. And, of course, McNary, that was on another district, so somebody else was running that, you know, measuring loads on that sawmill.
Okay.
But there was a lot of activity at that time for timber, which is no longer happening.
How was it that you ended up getting moved from Springerville out to the, would have been the Tucson Ranger District?
Yeah, it's just, it's a promotion.
Okay.
Is what it was. It's, you know, I was timber staff, and then when I went to Tucson, I became a ranger, which is...
And when was that?
In the early 70s, I guess.
Okay. Well, let's see now. It was the late 60s to Springerville, and you were there for 6 years?
Yeah.
So it made maybe 74-ish?
73, 74.
73, 74, okay.
Because I was there during the centennial. Bicentennial.
Ah, okay. And at that time, then Merle Stitt
was
superintendent.
Yep.
Robert Lovgren had left.
Yeah, he was gone. Merle was superintendent.
Okay.
And he was. When I left, I'm not quite sure. I think Merle had already retired, and Dick Marks, was it Dick Marks?
Mm hmm. Mm-hmm.
Came in for a short period of time, then I was gone. And
okay.
I went from there to Ranger at Happy Jack.
Okay. What was your first meeting with Merle like? What was he like?
I think the first time I met him was after I got there, I was invited to join the Rotary, and that's where I met Merle. And of course, He's one of those people, never met a stranger too, you know, and we got to chatting and found out he was in the rough neighborhood, grew up in the rough neighborhood I did back in Pennsylvania. So we had a little bit in common.
He had a science background. He was actually, he wasn't up through law enforcement. He was a very interesting fellow that way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he was a forester, I think. That's what he was.
Okay.
I don't know where, remember where he went to school, but I think he was a graduate forester.
All right. Nice.
And, let's see. That's about the best I can come up with.
Okay. Who else do you remember was on Rotary at the time?
Bruce Shaw was a deputy superintendent. He's passed away since. They were good friends of ours. They live here in town, or they did. She's still alive.
What do you remember about Bruce?
He was a good deputy superintendent.
Okay.
He picked up the slack where Merrill left off, you know. And let's see, who else? I'm trying to think. There was... Names are really slipping fast on me now. Names,
okay.
I thought I'd never forget.
Oh, no worries.
But we had the U.S. magistrate there at the time.
That would have been...
you might come up with it.
Thomas McKay?
Yeah, Tom McKay. That's
now,
it.
His nickname was Mumbles. I just learned that.
Oh, really?
What do you remember about him?
Not a whole lot. He was... I know. He was just a real good, U.S. magistrate. He handled things pretty well, but I never got to know Tom really that well.
Okay. Did you guys have any court dealings? Were there any things that you needed
him
for?
No, the park handled him.
Okay.
We dealt with the U.S. magistrate here in town.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Let's see, who else was there? Golly, names just are slipping by, and most of them I thought I'd never forget. Just about anybody that was in management somehow or other, either for Fred Harvey or for the park.
I'm trying to remember who would have been the head of Fred at the time. I'm not sure.
Stu Corbett's was one, and Alan Nail was the first.
Alan Nail, sure. Yeah. Sure, okay. And Stu
Corbett. Corbitz, K-O-R-B-I-T-Z or something.
Okay. And that was a Fred Harvey. That was AMFAC, I guess.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. And how many people did you have on your staff there on the Tucson side?
Primary staff, I had 3.
Okay.
And I had a clerk, and I think about 2 other full-timers. It was a small district.
Mm-hmm.
I had a timber staff assistant along with the timber staff.
Okay.
I had a recreation staff. I had a range staff.
Were you doing any timber sales?
Small ones, yes.
Okay. And were you staying then right there at the compound at the ranger station there and the housing there?
Well, that's where we all lived, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The office was down in Tucson. The office used to be at the ranger station. And when I got there, of course, they leased a building down in Tucson.
Really?
And we were there for several years. And then I guess they moved, finally decided to build the ranger station back up on the government property again.
Okay. Who did you lease that building from? Do you remember?
Yeah. He was Bert. He lived here in town. Oh, shit.
So I'm thinking of Seibold. I'm thinking of Calverson, who of course was over there, but and Rotter, Thurston's.
No, the fellow that owned this piece of land was here in town.
Okay. Mace? No. I'm trying to remember who that.
He was quite a character. Yes. He and I had this deal, you know, if anything was wrong, don't call GSA, call me.
Okay.
You know, and we'll get it ironed out together.
Get it sorted out. That's nice.
Hustler.
Where was the building?
It's gone now. Huh? You know where the campground is just before you leave Tucson?
Uh-huh.
It was right just a little bit south of that.
So where the 10X is or where the trailer park is?
No, I'm talking about the trailer park
on the north side.
Yeah,
okay.
North
All right.
Tucson.
All right. So there's the We Cook Pizza, the cooks there.
Yeah, I don't even know if the building's still there.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Was Yossi Lopez working? Was the little bar going out there? I'm trying to remember what else. What else was happening in Tucson at this time? Tucson.
They were trying to grow up, not getting anywhere with it. It finally happened, I guess, a little bit. They got a fire department finally and a few other things, but it wasn't incorporated at the time, and it was pretty much owned by one person.
That would have been Bob Thurston?
Well, yeah.
Or the Thurston family.
The family, yeah.
Yeah.
And,
did you know Clarinda Vale at the time? Okay. Any of the Thurston kids?
Johnny, I know.
Okay.
He was a kid then.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
My wife just saw him a few weeks ago.
Oh, fun.
And let's see, it was usually Bill that I dealt with. Bob was pretty old. And very little dealings with him, really. But I think that's what's stymied the growth of Tucson, you know, it's just, it was their land. I don't even know if Valley ever bought the hotel or not, and whether that was on Thurston land or whether in Lee Stelling, you know,
it's very complicated, and
I have no idea what's going on there, but you know, most of the land was Thurston's land.
Did you participate in the Legion there?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
All right. Because I just remember that Rotter ended up, Frank. Ended up getting some Legion land. They had a little bit of land there.
Mm-hmm.
And his
restaurant.
When he split up with Elling and Seibold and their 3-way, I think, into the Squire, then he was able to get that land over there and build that hotel.
Build that restaurant.
Yeah.
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 I don't even know the history of that area, but I don't know whether Elling owned any, like I say, owned the land or leased it. The water tank across the highway from there went in while I was there.
Okay.
You know, because they were hauling water like crazy.
And
didn't have a place to put it, really, to speak of. So we worked on getting that tank on National Forest, that water tank.
Okay. But, and then were the helicopters starting to come and go out of town there?
They were there all the time. Yeah, they were downtown. And before they moved, I guess they're all in the airport now, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't get back that much.
Okay. Okay. So let's go back to Merle for a little bit.
Sure.
Get any good Merle stories?
Not really. He about the only time I'd see him at Rotary, but not always converse with him. But we'd meet about once a month. Forest Society of American Foresters would have a meeting in this area, and he would always drive in with us when we went to meeting to go to a meeting here. But,
okay.
And that's when I got to visit with him and learn and know him the most.
Nice.
But a just outstanding man. In fact, two of my favorite people, I can't say they're in the Forest Service. I think they're these two right here. And both of them in the Park Service, and I was Forest Service.
Stitt and Riffey. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So I was thrilled to death when I got that photo.
Yeah. Yeah. Very nice. What else do you remember about your time at the Tucson district there?
It was probably the best assignment I ever had. The mixture of people was just outstanding. You know, we had cowboys, we had Indians, we had hippies. We had people that would drive several hundred miles for fine dining in the evenings. People that went to the symphony. Just a really neat assortment of people. And you get to know all of them.
Yeah.
Because they were all right around there.
Nice.
Yeah, that was probably one of the better things that I liked about that place. Plus, we had a good time there.
Okay.
Just the guys I worked with liked to have a good time, and we did.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the names of the other people that were there?
Forest Service?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. I started off with a timber staff by the name of Gerald Jimeno, who was a Filipino kid. He was American, really, but he was Filipino origin. He was followed by, and then I had Mike. Oh, Lordy, my names are going to heck on me. But Gerald was timber staff, and then I had Tommy Beto, who is a timber staff later on.
How would Tommy have spelled his last name?
T-O-M-B-E-D-D-O-W.
B-E-D-D-O-W.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a fellow by the name of Gary Loving. He was recreation.
Okay.
And his wife, Nancy, was worked for the History Association there.
Okay. For the Grand Canyon
Natural History. Well, whatever they're calling it now.
Yeah, well, it's Grand Canyon Association now, but I think it was the Grand Canyon
Natural History Association. That's, I was on the board of that for about 70 years.
Okay. Was that when you were at
Canyon?
At Canyon.
And then shortly after, too, when I moved to Happy Jack, I'd go back for board meetings once in a while. Let's see, a guy by the name of Cal Wettstein, who went on to be a ranger up in Colorado.
Wettstein,
I think.
Okay, Wettstein?
Wettstein.
Okay.
Wettstein. I can't remember. It's Swiss.
Okay.
Let's see. Guy by the name of Ron Melcher, who is fire.
M-E-L-C-H-E-R?
Yeah. He's down in the Verde Valley right now.
Okay.
Gary Loving and Tom are over in the Eager area.
Okay.
Let's see who else. Loretta Gonzalez was my clerk, and she was outstanding.
Hmm.
Let's see. And a guy by the name of Martin Freshour, Freshour.
Okay.
He was my range staff.
Did you have any poaching? Did you have any people camping out of bounds?
Oh, yeah.
What sort of stuff did you have to deal with there?
Oh, yeah. Well, there was no living areas there, so all those people come for summer jobs would move out onto the forest and set up camp, and we had to move them off after their 14 days.
So would they then just go quarter mile down the road and set up another 14-day encampment?
Or find a better hiding place, you know?
Okay. Okay.
I got a cute story to go with that. There was, at the time, the deputy sheriff up there was a guy by the name of Steve Luckison. Have you ever heard that name?
No.
He was a county deputy sheriff up there.
How do you spell his last name?
L-U-C-K-I-S-O-N, I think.
Okay.
But he was one of these guys that was always anxious to do stuff and just bully himself around. So I got two stories, really. One of them, we had a fire right behind Moki Lodge, the old Moki Lodge, and had a crew on it, and I was over there, and Steve shows up. He says, "Want to help?" I said, "You need a hard hat." So he goes back to the trunk, puts on his motorcycle helmet that the deputies wear. He said, "Now," he says, "can I go?" I says, "Go." So he's out there fighting the fire, and all of a sudden I hear, bang, bang, bang. He lost the bullets out of his belt, and they were falling
into the fire. And then it was exploding as they got hot.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
They didn't go anywhere.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
And then another time, Ron Melcher sent him and Ron out to get rid of some people up behind Toucan there that were well over their 14-day limit.
Okay.
Some kids. And so Ron and Steve go out there and they find these kids and they're in their tent napping, waiting. I guess they had a night shift or something. But he wakes them up. Steve wakes them up, you know. And they were definitely close to underage, you know, definitely not 21. And laying out there in the sun was a couple of beers, you can't, unopened. So they roused these kids out of bed. Steve starts giving them a hard time about camping there, and they're going to have to move. And Ron's just standing there letting them do his thing. You know, he always had to take charge. So, while he's talking to these kids, he's kicking this one beer can around. And then he says, "Oh, by the way," he says, "are these your beers?" And he said, "No, that's not our beer." So he pulls out his buck knife, opens it up, and plunges one in, and it just, after it was cooking in the sun, Rod said he couldn't, he had to turn around and walk away. But it's just typical Steve, you know. He was quite a character.
Hmm.
But then he was married to one of the girls that worked at the Squire at the time, I think. But I don't think that marriage lasted.
Hmm. Okay.
But that was just a side story that was, I always thought was kind of funny.
Wonderful. Very fun. Poaching? Poaching a problem?
Okay. Not much, dog. The only one, like I said, I told you earlier, is that one at Nixon Springs. I think I didn't see the deer, and I wasn't about to look for it.
Yeah.
I know it was there somewhere, getting a drink.
Just trying to think about, of course, the visitation through the district was huge, because everybody was going to the park.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were swamped.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had that 10X campground. We remodeled that while I was there.
Hmm.
And other than that, we took the overflow because the park would kick them out. And as a result, why, we'd just send them down these side roads. And you could go down some of those side roads, and it'd be 20, 25 RVs and campers all just barely pulled off the road camping the night there.
It's the same way down the Arizona Strip Road, if you, or not the Arizona Strip, but the Arizona Trail, the old Moki Stage Trail out by Grandview Lookout.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Down that way, that road is just pull up, pull up, pull out.
Right by Grandview Lookout, you mean?
Yeah.
That's too bad. Yeah, yeah. We never had much activity there, but right along the highway and the canyon from Williams, it was just.
Mm.
Just a pain.
Yeah.
You know, we'd throw garbage cans out and they'd use them. That's the good news. And things usually stayed pretty clean because they're only one-nighters,
right.
You know.
Right.
But then they had, a lot of them had trailers and RVs, which they carry their own garbage out anyhow.
Hmm. So you were there then from the sort of mid-70s to the mid-80s?
Early
80s. Early 80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, 73, 74 to 80.
Okay.
And then 80, I went to see Happy Jack.
Okay. Then the you mentioned remodeling the 10X campground.
Right.
Did you enlarge that at the time? Or?
No, it wasn't. We changed the entrance. The campground got a little bit bigger, but not much.
Okay.
We put water in it.
Oh.
That was the main thing. We put a water storage tank in the park, got agreement with the park, and they'd send their trucks out and fill the water.
Okay.
So they had water in the campground there.
And so the water that the park had would have been the Roaring Springs water coming across the canyon.
That's all we had too at the
okay.
Tucson.
Okay.
At the
really?
House, you know.
So you guys didn't have your own water catchment?
There was originally, and it was right next to my house, but we put up a tower at 2CN and a water storage at the campground.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen the tower, probably, water tower.
I don't think I have.
The ranger station on the right. It's pretty well hidden, but it's not totally hidden.
Okay.
And while I was there, we put those in.
Hmm.
And then the park would, and a pumping system.
Okay.
The park just offloaded and pumped it all the way up to the top of the water tower.
And then gravity feed back out to the buildings.
And, out, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, when I was there originally, all that was there was the Forest Service.
Okay.
Then the FAA moved in.
And
then Game and Fish moved in.
Okay.
And the county sheriff moved in. So these are all trailers that had happened afterwards.
Interesting.
Because there's no place.
Right.
You know, the best thing about Grand Canyon was if you had a place to live, you had a job.
That's right. That's right.
And my kids never had trouble getting jobs.
Because they could.
Yeah, they had a place to live.
They had a place to live at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was
very interesting. And I knew that the FAA was over there, but I didn't realize that everybody else that
yeah, the FAA. And then
Sheriff.
Game and Fish. Those are individuals, though. They weren't groups like
right.
The FAA. And I don't know who else is in there, but there are probably some other agencies.
Is FAA housing still in there now?
As far as I know, it is.
Okay. I never even thought about it. They got the tower there, and well, where do those people live?
Yeah.
Because I thought they had some housing for them actually by the airport, but maybe not.
So, I don't know. I think they're, as far as I know, of course, I've been out of there so many years now.
Right.
I don't know for sure, but the houses, I think the buildings are still there. They
okay.
were those modular homes, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
They bring them in on wheels and take the wheels and axles off. And
put up a little skirting and there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So I became mayor. You know, that there were usually some disputes going on, but not too many.
Okay.
You know, and it usually wasn't my people. It was always the FAA people didn't like each other or something.
Oh.
So they ironed it out themselves, I let them.
Yeah, yeah. What else do you remember about those times?
Ooh. The do I remember? It was, we were busy all the time. There's no doubt about that. There was a lot of work to be done there, and we accomplished a lot. Like I said, we got a whole lot of stuff in there that was really needed, like water supplies and a model remodel campground, and set things up. And of course, today they're leased out now, I guess, to not leased out, but private people running now.
Right, right. Manage the campgrounds,
yeah,
and host.
It's usually an association or something, mm-hmm, that takes, mm-hmm, it on and then gets the hosts for the campgrounds.
Right.
And that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And that, at the time I was there, we did everything. We picked up the garbage, cleaned out the outhouses, pumped out the outhouses.
Where did you put the garbage?
There was a landfill across just about 3 or 4 miles out on that road right across from the Squire.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Out going east?
Yeah, going east.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that's where the landfill was. And then a couple enterprising young ladies that worked for me for the summer one time, they decided to open up their own garbage business. So they took care of some of the local, you know, the houses and some of the businesses.
Okay.
To haul garbage. It's just free enterprise. They took on the job. So I don't know what's happened now, but I'm sure they're generating a lot more garbage than they ever did.
I remember someone told me there was a group of people that started a trash hauling company called Super Trash.
Super Trash, right. That's them.
That's them.
Yeah.
Do you remember who was doing that?
Yeah, there were a couple of young ladies, and they were, I can't remember last names. One was Michelle, and the other one, I can't, I'm having a hell of a time,
okay,
with memory. Anyway.
Well, no worries. No worries.
But those are the ones that started it.
Okay.
Called Super Trash. Yep.
Okay.
That was it.
Fun. Fun. Hmm. Yeah.
It.
Quite some changes with helicopters all moved out to the airport. The airport got a lot bigger. Was a lot of flight traffic coming in to the airport at the time, certainly when you would have been there.
Yeah. We had one plane crash while I was there.
Hmm.
Up in that burned area just on 2CN, just to the north and west of the ranger station, just before you get to, there's a big open area there before you get to the old Moki Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And one went down there, but nobody was really hurt. Yeah, that was scary.
I bet. Yeah.
Just minor bruises and cuts. Mm. And I don't remember, was it takeoff or landing or what, but I think it was a takeoff that they couldn't get enough altitude.
Exactly.
Density.
That was the big issue at 7,000 feet, mm-hmm, thin air,
yep,
not enough power, overloaded. You'd load up with fuel and you'd a bunch of people on board, and that plane would not want to take off. And you'd burn up the runway, and then.
Well, we had the, at that time, we did have the Story Bomber.
Okay.
In the summer months.
Really?
Yeah,
all right.
For about 6 weeks or 7 weeks during fire season.
Okay.
The bomber worked out of the airport at Grand Canyon.
And the crews would stay where? Would they be in hotels at the time?
They'd stay at the hotel. They were private people, yeah. They'd stay at the hotels.
Okay.
Before I got there, there's a story about one of the pilots that came home kind of lit and saw that the Canyon Squire was on fire. And he drove out to the airport, got into the bomber and dropped the load on top of the Squire. That was before I got there. Of slurry.
Oops.
No fire department.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, my gosh.
I don't know whatever came of it or anything, but it happened just before, a year or so before I got there.
I've never heard that story.
Yeah.
Huh.
It was interesting because that was his hotel. That's where he was staying.
I'll take care of this. I'll just drop a bunch of slurry on you. Hang on. I remember Franz Rutter actually talking about a story where they did have a fire out there, and it was touch and go for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's rough because there was no fire department.
Right. And no water.
It was us, and that was it. Mm. We only had a little I think at that time, a 200-gallon...
brush truck.
truck, yeah.
Kind of thing, yeah.
And a 20-gallon or a 50-gallon one, too, and that's about it.
Yeah, small. Huh.
It's really interesting.
very fine. Anything else you want to add that we're sitting chatting before we...
I can't think of anything. That pretty much covers my entire career.
Sam Wolfskill, thank you so very, very much for this wonderful interview.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's going to be interesting.
Today is the 11th of July, 2018. It's a Wednesday. And my name is Tom Martin, and this will conclude this Grand Canyon Oral History interview. Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome.